disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you find our show interesting and you'd like to support us, please consider heading over to patreon.com/deadsouls and donating to our research and investigations. If Instagram is more your thing, you can find us there by searching Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. So, we have received some feedback in regards to the rewards that we offer, or lack thereof, over on our Patreon and Ko-Fi pages. As always, we hear you and take on board your comments, so we will be reviewing the rewards that we offer in exchange for your support and updating our pages by the end of March, so that's the end of this month. Whilst we take a look at this, we welcome any suggestions or requests that you have in regards to what we should offer. Message us via Instagram or Twitter, or email us at deadsoulspodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you and hear your ideas. Now, for tonight's show, this is Waco, David Koresh and the Branch Davidian Cult. This year marks the 30th anniversary of one of the strangest and most tragic incidents in American religious history. The bloody and tragic ending of the siege between the FBI and the Branch Davidian religious cult in Waco, Texas. Waco is synonymous in the American zeitgeist with the story of a maniacal cult leader and his group of followers, a story that will go terribly, terribly wrong. The 1993 media coverage of the Waco siege, which depicted cult leader David Koresh as a self-identified Christ-like figure exerting his power over his Branch Davidian followers through a form of mind control, has by now become the defining story of the massacre. The siege lasted for 51 days, and ultimately 86 people would die, mostly cult members. But what happened, and why did it happen? The Branch Davidians and their leader, David Koresh, held themselves up, heavily armed, in a barricaded building, as the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or the ATF, endeavored to execute their search warrant on the cult's compound in Mount Carmel, 20 miles northeast of Waco. The standoff became hot news across the nation and the Western world, as law enforcement attempted to negotiate with Koresh and his followers. But the religious group refused to submit to the ATF, who patiently waited, hoping that eventually they would give themselves up. The story of David Koresh is a puzzle filled with allegations of child sexual abuse, polygamy, misconduct, and maniacal behavior. The Waco siege and the Branch Davidian cult would prove to be one of the most horrific and controversial government sieges to occur in the history of the United States. But more so, it would affect American civilization permanently and have a direct knock-on effect to further criminal incidences throughout the 1990s and 2000s. A brief side note at this juncture. Yes, I do refer to the Branch Davidians as a cult throughout this episode. I apologize if that offends anyone. I have done this, however, as that is exactly how David Koresh and a number of his ex-followers referred to themselves. I just want to be clear. Anyway, David Koresh was born Vernon Wayne Howell on the 17th of August 1959 in Houston, Texas. His mother, Bonnie Sue Clark, was just 14 years old when he was born, while his father, Bobby Wayne Howell, was 19. Bobby left Bonnie shortly before Koresh was born, in favor of another teenage girl, leaving Bonnie to care for her newborn son alone. After this, she began living with another man. He was a violent alcoholic, but Bonnie was devoted. After just 18 months, Bonnie ditched Koresh and chose her lover, leaving baby David with his grandmother, Aline Clark. Koresh was raised with Aline's two other children and referred to his grandmother as Mama. His aunt recalled that at this time Koresh was loved and raised by several family members. But things took a turn when Bonnie returned 5 years later and Koresh was reunited with his mother. Bonnie was by now married to a carpenter named Roy Haldeman. Haldimand was 16 years her senior, and the couple already had a newborn son together named Roger. Roy had an old-school way of disciplining the children, and Koresh would later say, "When I used to act up, when I had a bad school report card, can you imagine, we got our tails whacked." Roy, for his part, denied these claims and stated, "Sure, we had our normal problems, but we got along okay." When he was 14, Koresh was allowed to return to live with his grandmother and the siblings that he'd grown up with. His family stated that this was a stable period in his life. As his grandmother had moved into a smaller house, he didn't have his own bedroom indoors, but transformed an old shed in the backyard into his new living quarters, with a bed and posters of rock stars from the 1970s on the walls. Koresh was popular with the girls during this time too, but it all came to an end when his grandfather decided he didn't want him in the home any longer, and Koresh was sent back to Dallas to be with Bonnie. Koresh later told the FBI that his childhood was a lonely one, but his mother stated that he had lots of friends and described him as a cute, lovable little boy and very inquisitive. Bonnie added that his son loved taking things apart, spending time outdoors and making up stories. As Koresh had poor study skills and dyslexia, he was placed in a special education class where he was nicknamed Vernie by his classmates. He didn't enjoy school and was bullied a lot by fellow pupils. In his junior year at age 16, he decided to drop out of Garland High School and began working in construction and carpentry. Koresh had an interest in religion from a young age, and he began reading the Bible and listening to Christian radio stations at around age 12. By the time he was 18, he had memorized both Old and New Testaments, all 1,200 pages. Further, as a child, Koresh claimed that God told him that he was the chosen one. His 16-year-old girlfriend, who Koresh dated for 7 months when he was 18, stated that he never once mentioned the Bible or religion to her. However, at the time he was very invested in music and would often play guitar for hours on end, she said. The relationship would fizzle out when his girlfriend discovered that he'd been seeing another girl who subsequently became pregnant by Koresh. He intended to meet with the second girl's family to discuss the matter, but he never showed up to the arrangement. He did later attempt to marry the girl that he had impregnated, but her family were dead against it and would not allow it. Over the following months, Koresh experienced what friends and family described as an emotional crisis. He didn't have a steady job, had no permanent address, and he was struggling with a strong sexual appetite. His family recalled that he prayed a lot, and he lost a lot of weight. During this time, Koresh also formed a band, but it didn't lead anywhere. He went to Los Angeles for a short time in an attempt to become a musician, but those dreams were never realized either. He also, during this period in his life, met up with his biological father, Bobby Wayne, in Houston. They both bonded over their shared interests in carpentry and mechanical engineering, but the relationship never blossomed much further. His crisis appeared to come to an end when Koresh joined the Southern Baptist Church, claiming to be a born-again Christian. Koresh, however, was only there a short while before he joined his mother's religious denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. Here he became a well-known member of the community. He was given a room in exchange for work by a woman living on a farm, and he stopped playing the guitar as he felt rock music was linked with Satan. As Koresh became a religiously reformed man, he turned his attention to those around him. He was particularly critical of women in the church and openly displayed a personality of misogyny. He told at least one father in the church, for example, that he felt his daughter's dress was immodest and she needed to dress more appropriately. Despite this new attitude, he still continued to have numerous promiscuous sexual relationships with women, though. According to Koresh's family, he was a changed man when he began attending Revelation seminars, which were conducted by the evangelist Jim Gilley. The seminars spoke about Armageddon and painted dramatic and terrifying portraits of the coming end of days. Koresh attended the seminars every night of the week and felt that he had more to add to Gilley's teachings. Gilley rejected his ideas, however, so Koresh then attempted to inform the other members of the church that it was time to have a new prophet and a new guiding light. He added that he was the person to bring about the change. Nobody in the congregation bought what he was selling, and a spurned Koresh turned his attention to the Branch Davidians. The Branch Davidians were an apocalyptic religious movement which was founded in 1955 by Benjamin Rodin. It was itself an offshoot of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the same church which Koresh's family were members of. Branch Davidian members believe in the imminent return of Jesus Christ, and that living prophets can decipher God's word in the Bible. Although Benjamin Rodin is noted as the founder of the movement, he himself was a follower of Victor Hotef, the founder of the Davidian Seventh-day Adventist organization known as the Shepherd's Rod. Hotef was a Bulgarian immigrant who called for a reform of the SDA Church, which is why he formed his offshoot organization. Much like Koresh, however, Hotef's ideas were rejected by the SDA leaders. Hotef and a small group purchased a compound near Waco, Texas in 1935. It was at this compound that the group began prepping for the return of Christ, living a simple life where they were entirely self-sufficient. The group felt that the SDA had abandoned the task of preparing for Christ's return in favor of worldly pursuits. When Hotef died in 1955, his wife Florence took over the organization. April 22, 1959 was the date, she proclaimed, on which Jesus Christ would return to earth. When the date came and went, and her prediction failed to come true, the group began to fracture and eventually splintered into several factions. By 1962, Florence had disbanded her following and sold the Waco property the group had been living in. The group had named the property the Mount Carmel Center, after the biblical mountain of the same name. Meanwhile, at the same time, Benjamin Rodin claimed to be hearing messages from God, who was telling him to continue the work of his former leader, Hotef. Rodin's claims, much like Florence Hotef's before him, also split the group, and once Florence had completely abandoned the movement, Rodin took over from her. Rodin and his followers purchased another property in Waco, which they also named the Mount Carmel Center. Rodin and his followers believed that Mount Carmel, which was now a 77-acre piece of land, after both properties were combined, would be the center of a new divine kingdom following the apocalypse. In 1981, Koresh moved to Waco and joined the Branch Davidians. By this time, Rodin's widow, Lois Scott, was leading the group after Rodin had passed away in October of 1978. Lois was in her late 60s, and she would oversee the organization until her successor would step in, when she either stepped back or passed away. George Rodin, the eldest son of Lois and Benjamin, had assumed that he would take over the Branch Davidians following his mother's death. However, what he didn't expect was that he would have stiff competition. At first, Koresh's involvement in the organization seemed innocent enough. He began conducting door-to-door recruitment on behalf of the church. He also placed advertisements in local press to promote their existence to state citizens. Koresh also, at this time, grew close to a man named Perry Jones. Jones had a 14-year-old daughter named Rachel Perry, and both him and his wife were lifelong members of the church and gave Koresh permission to marry Rachel, which was ultimately his one and only legal wife. Together, they had two children, a son named Cyrus, and a daughter who Koresh named Star. At the time of his marriage to 14-year-old Rachel, Koresh was 10 years her senior at 24 years old. Koresh also resumed his hobby of guitar playing once again. He began playing and singing at church services, and was a gifted public speaker who appeared to be highly empathetic and charismatic. In 1983, the year that he married Rachel, there was rumors circulating around the congregation that Koresh was also having an affair with the movement's leader Lois, who was 67 at the time. Lois then began to allow Koresh to begin teaching his own message, named the Serpent's Root, which caused some controversy among Lois's followers. Koresh also began to claim that God had chosen him to father a child with Lois, and that the child would be the chosen one. A brazen claim, but one that was accepted in the group. Lois suffered a miscarriage, however, and Koresh blamed the miscarriage on her lack of faith. He said he was now the spiritual leader, and he had the faith necessary to lead the group. As a result, Lois began to lose her authority in the eyes of the congregation. An article by the Waco Tribune Herald, dated January of 1988, details the rivalry between Koresh and Lois's eldest son, George. Koresh was a well-liked young man and was readily accepted by the Branch Davidian community. He put his carpentry skills to good use by repairing buildings at the Mount Carmel property, participated in lively church services by demonstrating his musical abilities, and won over the other group members by exhibiting a keenness to learn and understand the organization's way of life. However, the failure to see eye to eye between George and Koresh only led the group to become even more fractured yet again. One follower noted that everyone had been won over by Koresh and accepted that he was the next prophet, as Lois announced shortly before her death from breast cancer in 1986. The only people who continued to oppose this notion was George and a very small few followers that he had in the church. Tensions grew in 1983 when a fire broke out in the Mount Carmel property, destroying an administration building and a printing press worth around $500,000. George blamed the fire on Koresh, accusing him of arson, while Rachel's father Perry defended his son-in-law, stating that the fire was a judgment of God and that no man set that fire. After the fire, George ordered Koresh and his followers out of the property by gunpoint. He then changed the name from Mount Carmel to Rodenville and blocked the entrance with barricades, stating that the barricades were designed to protect Rodenville just like the White House is protected. George also exclaimed that the barricades prevented assassination attempts of him and his followers from car bombs. Seven families in total decided to remain with George at the newly named Rodenville. Koresh and his followers left the compound and set up residence in Palestine, Texas, roughly 90 miles away from Waco, in a wooded area of land. They lived the rough existence where they slept in buses or tents for the next few years. Perry told the Waco Tribune Herald that their setup was only a temporary solution. They lived in 5-foot by 7-foot plywood boxes and used small stoves they purchased on sale from a local department store. Each of the boxes had a small loft area for sleeping, but no insulation. Instead, each inhabitant lit up the night sky using kerosene lamps, which also provided some heat. About 20 children remained with Koresh's group. There was structure and the children attended school classes led by Sherry Jewell in an old converted school bus that was missing its wheels. Everybody pitched in to help with the chores as a communal teamwork mentality, and what little there was found itself shared out equally. Weightlifting equipment was also piled in one corner of the camp and vehicles lined the perimeter of the wooded area to mark the group's settlement boundaries. The church had access to only a single telephone, which sat on a small log structure in the center of the camp. Outdoor seating consisted of old couches arranged in circles. During this period, David Koresh wrote a song about George Roden, which he titled Madman in Waco. In a flutter of entrepreneurship, Koresh recorded the track and sold the cassettes for cash locally. In 1987, George proposed that him and Koresh engage in a resurrection competition, the winner of which would be established as overall leader of the Branch Davidian movement. George believed he was the true successor of the organization's leadership and was confident that God would guide him to victory. In preparation, George disinterred the corpse of a deceased member of the church, an 85-year-old woman named Anna Hughes, who had died some 20 years prior. Koresh had no interest in participating in this kind of contest. Further, his followers deemed it immature and a waste of time and didn't support it either. George would later deny any notion of a resurrection competition, especially as Koresh's group had rejected the idea so vehemently. He instead stated that he was simply moving the ground cemetery and that there never was a competition. Koresh and his followers were deeply unhappy knowing that the burial ground was being disturbed. Perry Jones even had a child buried there himself. So after learning about George's actions, the group began to research state laws about corpse abuse and headed to the local sheriff's department to make a complaint. They hit an obstacle right away, though, when they were told that they would need to acquire a photograph of any disturbed or desecrated bodies in order to move forward with a legal complaint. Undeterred, however, the group returned with a picture of Anna's casket removed from the ground. The sheriff's office informed the group that law enforcement specifically needed an image of the body or human remains rather than her casket in order to move forward. So, next, Koresh and about seven of his followers purchased camouflage outfits from Kmart and headed to George's compound. What happens next varies depending on where you source the story from. What we know for certain is that Koresh and his group of men went into Rodenville armed with weapons. Perry Jones told the Waco Tribune Herald, "We didn't go into this with our eyes closed. The sheriff had been patrolling the place for a while because of George's reputation with guns. We knew what we had to do." Soon after, Koresh and his supporters arrived. The scene quickly descended into chaos. Koresh ran into George Roden almost immediately. George was armed with a submachine gun. A short exchange of gunfire ensued between both sides. George was shot in the hand and the chest. Law enforcement quickly arrived at the scene just before anyone could be seriously injured. George would make a full recovery. There are to this day mixed reports over the intentions of Koresh's group that night. Koresh has stated that they intended to obtain photographs of the disturbed bodies, although they had forgotten to take their camera equipment, Koresh stated. Both Koresh and his followers were charged with attempted murder, and they went to trial. The trial lasted for 2 weeks, where Koresh explained that he had gone to the compound with respectable intentions and was looking for evidence of corpse abuse. He had shot at a tree, not at George, he added. All of Koresh's followers were acquitted, while the judge declared a mistrial regarding David Koresh himself. All of their weapons were seized and confiscated by law enforcement, including several .2 and .3 caliber semi-automatic rifles, two shotguns, and a 2.22 caliber rifle. Following the acquittal, the rifles were eventually returned to the group, but not the shotguns. George, for his part in the incident, believed that the group had come to kill him. He stated as much to law enforcement and admitted that he was ready to fight back and kill them if he had to. In 1988, George spent 9 months in jail under contempt of court charges. He had reportedly used foul language during court proceedings. Additionally, George had lived on the Rodenville compound after being ordered not to by a court judge. He had also been ordered not to call himself the leader of the Branch Davidians in a court case that dated back to 1979. George was in contempt of court and his actions caught up with him. In October 1989, George Roden murdered a man in Odessa, Texas named Wayman Dale Adair. George shot Adair and finished the job by hitting him over the head with a wood hatchet. Wayman was a guest at George's residence, but George got disgruntled when Adair began announcing that he was the true Messiah. George claimed that Koresh had sent Adair to assassinate him, so he had to defend himself. Even though George would ultimately be found not guilty of the murder of Adair, the not guilty verdict was by reason of insanity, and thus George was admitted to a psychiatric hospital in Big Springs, Texas. George died of a heart attack in 1998, age 60, still confined in that very same mental hospital. By the time Koresh and his followers finished up in court, George had been instructed to leave the property and also owed thousands of dollars in unpaid taxes on it. The remaining Branch Davidians raised the money to reclaim Rodenville for themselves and returned the name to Mount Carmel. David Koresh quickly took the helm of the Branch Davidian Church and became the new leader. And in 1990, he legally changed his name from Vernon Wayne Howell to David Koresh. He said it was for publicity and business purposes. His name had been carefully chosen as it was the biblical name of Cyrus the Great, a Persian king who was named a Messiah for freeing the Jewish people during the Babylonian captivity, and David because it symbolized the lineage directly to the biblical king David from whom the new Messiah would descend. Life in the church under Koresh's rule was not necessarily better. He made up arbitrary rules and his followers lived in poor conditions. There were also numerous allegations of abuse, both physical and sexual, towards children in the years during and after his reign. There was little to no heat, no electricity or running water at the compound and no creature comforts. Followers participated in Bible studies 3 times a day. Koresh's singing and guitar playing became an integral part of the study classes. Women were made to wear long blouses and were not permitted to wear any makeup or jewelry. Additionally, the group were told specifically where to sleep and what to eat. Sugar, dairy, and processed flour were not allowed, for example. Dairy was referred to by Koresh as baby food. There were many other strange and bizarre things that Koresh enforced within the church. Bananas and oranges couldn't be eaten together, and fruits and vegetables couldn't be eaten together within the same meal. In the wintertime, the group would survive on onion soup alone. Koresh ordered that the group stockpile canned goods and ready meals, enough for which would last up to a year. He also ordered the bungalows that lay on the outer rim of the compound to be fortified and make the compound secure on a military level. Koresh and the church started to collect more and more weapons, and intensive training was given to his followers, including the children, in military combat and tactics. By early 1993, this was all in place, and the church were armed to the teeth and a formidable force. This was all for what Koresh claimed would one day escalate into a defensive fight against the beasts of Babylon, which was his name for the government. They, he said, would trigger the apocalypse, and the Branch Davidians must prove themselves worthy of heaven and earn their place before God. The church made money by reselling weapons at trade fairs for a profit. While the members brought in the money, Koresh himself travelled abroad, visiting Australia, the United Kingdom, and Israel in search of new recruits. He found many and brought them back to Waco with him. According to former church members, children were savagely beaten for even the most minor infraction, such as spilling a glass of milk. One ex-church member, named Joanna Vega, said that she was hit regularly and beat until she bled. She added that the children of the church lived in fear of being beaten with such regularity that it felt almost constant and for little or no reason at all. She continued that, "I lived in fear that nothing you can ever do is going to be good enough. Pure futility. You're raised with just fear. Everywhere is fear." Another church member, Dana Akimoto, who gave birth to one of Koresh's children, a son named Sky, said in a 2003 interview that the children were kept in line using a wooden paddle and violence. She recalled being so under Koresh's control that she would beat her own son until he bled and pleaded with her. She stated, "If there was one thing I could take back, I would take back the spankings. I felt like the most evil person in the world to be beating my baby this way. But that was what God wanted and needed from me." David Koresh also had an insatiable sexual appetite that led him to ask all of his followers, even married couples, to embrace celibacy, before he then announced that all marriages were null, void, and dissolved. Now all the women in the movement would be his wives, should he want and choose them to be. Ex-church member David Buns said David Koresh's justification for taking all the women for himself was theological. "He is the one that had the power. He is the one that had the authority to give the seed." David also added that if Koresh had sex with a woman, you would say she was in the house of David. Koresh's beliefs led to spiritual marriages with both single and legally married women, and were based on a supposed revelation that involved the production of 24 children by specifically chosen women in the community. These 24 children were meant to serve as the 24 ruling elders after the return of Jesus Christ. With the 24 ruling elders idea coming from the book of Revelation specifically. Koresh fathered at least a dozen children outside of his marriage to Rachel Jones, and even had several children with Rachel's younger sister Michelle. They reportedly had two, Serenity C. Jones and Bobby Lynn Koresh. Koresh allegedly claimed that while traveling in Israel, he had a vision where he was commanded to have a child with Michelle. Rachel agreed because she dreamt that her husband would die if she didn't allow him to assault her younger sister. Her words. Koresh sexually assaulted Michelle when she was only 13 years old. A woman named Carrie Jewell, whose mother was Sherry, the woman who taught the children in the old school bus while in Palestine, Texas, claimed that she became a spiritual wife of Koresh when she was just 11 years old, and that her mother had been his 20th wife. Disturbingly, Koresh's own grandmother defended his actions, stating that his relationships with these children should be viewed in the context of the attitudes of rural East Texas. Furthermore, David Koresh should be taken at his word. He is God to all mankind. She said the youngest girl with a baby at the Branch Davidian compound was 14 years old. He never raped anybody in his life, his grandmother continued. They grew up faster in the church. Koresh was also known to brag about his sexual exploits in front of other members of the group, though. In the years following his death, a string of children who were formerly living at the Mount Carmel compound came forward to allege that he had molested them during that time living as part of the religious sect. David Bunn, speaking with ABC News, stated, "It's sick and perverted, and yet it's one of the things about David Koresh that probably bothers me the most. My position now is that David Koresh was a paedophile, and I wish I would have done something. I don't know what I would have done, but I wish I would have done something." Other incidents of child abuse include a time when Koresh, frustrated by the cries of his son Cyrus, apparently beat the child severely for several minutes on three consecutive trips to his room. Additionally, a male visitor of the compound who wishes to remain anonymous reported seeing a young boy be beaten with a stick so severely that it made him sick. It was common practice for Koresh to separate families, and in particular he would separate mothers from their children. If Koresh found that they had a closer bond than he had with the children, he would purposefully break that bond and destroy the relationship. Despite his horrific actions, Koresh was still seen as a persuasive and charismatic man, revered and loved by his followers who believed every word and teaching he gave them. To them, he was the embodiment of Christ. Members recalled that he could tell you the grass was blue, and you would believe it. His persuasion was said to be magical. The allegations of child abuse were investigated over a period of 6 months by the Texas Child Protection Services in 1992, but their investigation was inconclusive. A former member and one-time right-hand man to David Koresh, Mark Briault, is the one who drew attention to the abuse after he left the compound. There are some claims that the group concealed Koresh's relationships with the young girls by giving them substitute husbands who were more age-appropriate for them. Some ex-church members and defenders of the congregation have said that as the parents essentially gave consent for Koresh to marry or sleep with their daughters, that they dismissed the idea that there was any kind of issue or abuse there. But these opinions were dismissed outright by law enforcement, given Koresh's known methods of grooming, persuasion, and brainwashing techniques. Purportedly, the group came to the attention of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, or the ATF, when a UPS delivery driver accidentally discovered that he was delivering a box of explosives to the Mount Carmel compound. This led the ATF to believe that the Branch Davidians were in possession of a potential illegal firearms cache on their property. Through a brief investigation on the church, the ATF formed the opinion that the group had almost 250 weapons on site, including semi-automatic rifles, assault rifles, shotguns, revolvers, pistols, and hundreds of grenades. As a result of this discovery, the ATF wanted to arrest David Koresh for unlawful possession of a destructive device and to thoroughly search the 77-acre property for the weapons, seizing anything illegal. This action would be the exact scenario the Branch Davidians had been told by David Koresh would be the final war of the impending apocalypse, and all the church members knew that to be in God's favor and ascend to heaven, they had to fight. This is something that the ATF would have done well to have unearthed prior to executing any search warrants on Mount Carmel. On February the 28th, 1993, the ATF raided the Mount Carmel compound in Waco, Texas, in an attempt to execute the search warrant they had been given by a federal judge. According to the official government report, the Branch Davidians opened fire first. According to the Branch Davidians, the ATF shot first. While the ensuing gun battle on that day was short-lived, lasting around 2 hours, it resulted in the death of 6 members of the church and 4 ATF agents. 15 additional agents were injured in the gunfire. Following the initial raid, the FBI hostage rescue team took over as Koresh and his followers dug in and barricaded themselves inside the compound. As the ATF were a federal organization and agents were killed in the operation, the FBI took full jurisdiction and ownership of the situation. FBI negotiators quickly established contact with Koresh and discovered that he had been shot in the opening gunfight, receiving a bullet wound to his hip and his hand. The communication between the FBI and Koresh over the next 51 days included phone exchanges with various negotiators. In total, there were 117 conversations that lasted over 60 hours. The negotiations stalled, however, when Koresh and his associates brokered delays, which Koresh required so he could write religious documents needed, he said, before any surrender could take place. By the 51st day of the siege, there were around 130 people, the entirety of the Branch Davidian community, inside the main building of the Mount Carmel property. The authorities treated the situation as a hostage crisis, and the FBI believed that Koresh was simply a con artist who had manipulated a group of innocent people but would cave quickly to the pressures applied to him. But the FBI most certainly underestimated Koresh. Whilst you could argue that Koresh was peddling snake oil to his congregation, the FBI didn't factor in the truth that Koresh himself vehemently believed every single word that he preached. Koresh believed that he had a vital role in the lead-up to the apocalypse, that he was ordained by the grace of God and had the powers of the Almighty within him. In the days leading up to the end of the siege, Koresh and his behaviors shifted. He flirted between being a self-assured messiah to a hustler who treated the lives of those that followed him like poker chips. Malcolm Gladwell, writing for The New Yorker, wrote at the time, "The scale of the operation was enormous. The FBI assembled what has been called the largest military force ever gathered against a civilian suspect in American history. 10 Bradley tanks, 10 Abrahams tanks, 4 combat engineering vehicles, 660 federal agents, in addition to 6 U.S. customs officers, 15 U.S. Army personnel, 13 members of the Texas National Guard, 31 Texas Rangers, 131 officers from the Texas Department of Public Safety, 17 from the McLennan County Sheriff's Office, and 18 Waco Police. A massive total of 899 people to arrest and detain 130 church members." The FBI played the Federal Hostage Situation Guidebook like agents Johnson & Johnson at the base of Nakatomi Tower. Sleep deprivation tactics were used against the Branch Davidians first by blasting the sounds of rabbits being killed and choice death metal music pumped out of huge sound systems throughout the night. The FBI then flooded the compound to make the conditions inside the building utterly miserable. The FBI had the entire building surrounded and locked down tight. There was no possible way out for the Branch Davidians. At any moment, the huge federal force was awaiting an order to either completely roll over the compound and flatten everything in its path, begin heavy artillery shelling and bombing of the building, or storm the compound with all 800 heavily armed troops and receive the surrender of Koresh and his followers. The FBI was focused, and there was no way the United States government was going to lose in this situation. A decision and attitude that would have repercussions for decades to come. On March the 2nd, a follower of Koresh stated that he planned to come out of the building with a small group of people and blow themselves up. All those left inside the building would then kill each other and themselves. However, this plan was quickly cancelled because God told him not to carry it out at the last minute. 10 days before the end of the siege, Koresh contacted the authorities and said that he'd surrender if one of his sermons was broadcast on national radio. The FBI report of the incident from the Department of Justice archives and video footage shows that the sermon tapes were indeed played. The sermon was broadcast on Dallas radio station KRLD at 4 p.m. on March the 2nd. Around the same time, Steve Schneider, one of Koresh's closest confidants on the compound, called CNN and demanded that they tell the federal agents to call off the assault and stand down. He also tried to explain their religion briefly and gain sympathy and understanding. didn't work. Eventually, Koresh himself came to the phone with one of the CNN news anchors. Excited at the huge scoop they had received, the anchor opted to broadcast the phone conversation live on air. When the FBI command outside the Mount Carmel compound caught wind of what was happening, they were furious. They perceived any media access given to Koresh or the Branch Davidians intruded on the negotiations and made their position in the power balance weaker. The FBI, in the final day before the end of the siege, were able to successfully get some of the children from the compound. However, many would not leave their families, and families were reluctant to hand over their children to the FBI. On April 19, 1993, the siege came to a gruesome and catastrophic end. 51 days after it had begun, Attorney General Janet Reno, with specific approval from President Bill Clinton, approved the command for the FBI agents to proceed with a final advance in which the Branch Davidians would be removed from the property at any cost. Initially, the federal agents used tear gas to try and flush out Koresh and his group, but this was unsuccessful. During the advance, the Mount Carmel Center suddenly caught fire. The reasons why are still officially unclear to this day. Both sides blame the other for starting the blaze. Critics argue that the FBI were responsible for the fire, while others blame the FBI mostly for botching the negotiations and being too heavy-handed in their approach. Some ex-members of the church have come forward in the years since the siege and stated that they had been privy to conversations involving Koresh and other senior church leaders months before the siege, in which it was discussed that a fire would be purposefully started in the event of a government standoff. However, there is no hard evidence to verify this for certain. A religious studies professor at Loyola University named Catherine Wessinger asked if the FBI believed that they were dealing with members of a cult who were not in their right minds, and why would the FBI put so much pressure on them, and why would they carry out such a vicious assault, which ultimately only confirmed David Koresh and his crazy prophecies? As the flames engulfed the building, 44 people, including some children, managed to make their escape. Many, however, were trapped due to the doors that had been barricaded. 79 Branch Davidians died that day, including 21 children, who were under the age of 16. The remains of David Koresh, aged 33, were found with a single bullet wound in the middle of his forehead. It's unclear who killed him and why, although it's been speculated that he was killed by a follower to avoid the pain of dying in the fire. The FBI themselves specifically pointed to Steve Schneider, whose wife was known to be sleeping with Koresh. Steve and his wife Judy had been unable to conceive, but Judy later had Koresh's child. 20 other members had been shot to death in the face, chest and head, including 5 children below the age of 14. Possibly for the same reason why a 3-year-old was stabbed to death in the chest and 2 minors suffered fatal blows to the head. Sherry, the mother of Carrie Jewell, one of Koresh's child brides, also perished in the flames. Additionally, Koresh's legal wife Rachel, aged 23, and his sister Michelle, who was 18, both died in the fire. Their father Perry took his own life after being shot during the initial shootout. 4 months later, the federal grand jury indicted 12 Branch Davidians for aiding and abetting the murder of federal agents and illegally possessing firearms. 305 weapons were recovered by Texas Rangers in the aftermath of the siege. 4 Branch Davidians were acquitted of all charges, and 8 more were acquitted of further charges, but still faced various firearms offences for which they were convicted. By 2007, all of the convicted Branch Davidians were free from jail. In 1999, Attorney General Janet Reno appointed U.S. Senator John Danforth of Missouri to conduct an investigation into the handling of the situation by the ATF and FBI. 14 months and $70 million later, Danforth determined that the government did not cause the fire and did not direct gunfire at the Branch Davidian complex. He did, however, note that the FBI and Department of Justice had some failings, including that they did not disclose evidence about the pyrotechnic tear gas that they had used. He concluded the responsibility for the fire rests solely with the Branch Davidians and their leader, Vernon Howell, also known as David Koresh. The fire erupted from three separate locations inside the compound, but still nobody has any concrete answers about who is responsible for starting the blaze. The FBI, for their part, maintains that they did not find any weapons following the initial shootout. A survivor of the fire and the cult itself, David Tribideau, told Time magazine that he believes that the fire victims had been shot by the FBI, but admits that it's a possibility that the members may have shot themselves and each other to prevent the pain of the fire. Tribideau added that he didn't believe anybody inside the building would have started the fire. In this case, both parties blame one another. Today, Branch Davidians go by the name The Branch, the Lord Our Righteousness. Following the tragedy at Waco, they built a new church to the east of the old compound. Charles Pace took over the church's leadership, and much like David Koresh did before him, Charles declared himself the new Lamb of God of Revelations. After the fire, David Koresh was buried in Tyler Memorial Park in Tyler, Texas. Following the incident in Waco, Koresh's mother Bonnie defended her son's actions in the years that followed. She stated the Branch Davidians were an entirely harmless bunch of people, a misperception being that Koresh was anti-government and stockpiling guns to kill people. It simply wasn't true, she said. That was an absolute falsehood. David didn't have a mean bone in his body. David did not believe in murder, Bonnie continued. Bonnie was 64 when she was stabbed to death at the home of her sister Beverly near Chandler in Harrison County in 2009. Her sister Beverly was charged with the murder. The story of David Koresh and the Branch Davidians is a horrific and complex one that still fascinates people to this day. When asked about whether or not former members of the Branch Davidians felt like they were part of a cult, Donna Akimoto, the mother of Koresh's son Sky, said this: "We knew it was a cult. We would joke about it all the time. David Koresh even openly admitted that he was the leader of a cult." Another former member, David Burns, added, "I'll call it a cult. That's what it was. It's people doing things they wouldn't normally do, like giving up their wives and letting their children have sex with adults, which is crazy. But that's what you do when you're in a cult and brainwashed. Someone says they have the authority and then they impose upon you their rules and restrictions and expectations, and it gets down into your soul. It really screws you up." So what exactly caused David Koresh to become the abusive cult leader that we know him as today? A drive for power? His ego telling him he was meant for something bigger? An obsession perhaps with religion or a distrust in the government? Or maybe it simply boils down to him being a lonely man who was looking for somewhere to fit in, looking for meaning in his life and needing control. Maybe he was searching for answers as to why his own childhood was the way that it was, why he was abused at the hands of his stepfather and why he was bullied so badly in school, why he was kicked out of the only home that he'd ever known and loved. Whatever the reasons may be for the actions of David Koresh, it's clear that his determination to complete the mission he felt he had been given by God would ultimately lead to one of the worst outcomes and tragedies imaginable and in the history of the United States. We originally intended for this episode to include an interview at this point with an ex-member of the Branch Davidian Church who was present during the Waco siege and who was subsequently jailed in the United States for more than 10 years. Unfortunately, moments before our interview was set to begin, the interviewee insisted that they be allowed to broadcast a lengthy Branch Davidian sermon to our listeners. This is not something we were willing to allow on our podcast, and unfortunately, the interview was cancelled by the interviewee at that point. In its place, please enjoy a recording of David Koresh playing us out with his song, Madman in Waco. Please, won't you listen?
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.